Welcome to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age, the show designed to help make middle age your prime time of life by defying the notion that once you reach 40, 50, or even 60 years old, your crowning achievements are all behind you. Regardless of whether you're just approaching 40 or are firmly entrenched in your middle years, it's time to launch your very own personal journey toward a joyful and purpose-filled second half of life. Each week, host Roy Richards, an expert on midlife renewal and author of A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up, will discuss the challenges common to middle age and help guide you to a brighter tomorrow. Now, here's Roy.
Well, hello, and welcome to this week's program of Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age. And regular listeners know that our common program theme is that the key to a joyful and productive second half of life is to wake up to become CEO of you. And unfortunately, sometime during the year, if not already, some of us will be diagnosed with a chronic or a life-threatening disease, either ourselves or as a healthcare advocate for a spouse, a loved one, or an aging parent. And on our recent December 30th broadcast, our guest Julia Shofik urged anyone confronted by life-threatening illness to personally take charge, in consultation, of course, with physicians, but take charge of that battle to overcome and control the disease. And remember, you can go back and listen or re-listen to our December 30th broadcast at any time, the wonderful advantage of internet radio. And today's guest is going to expand on the subject of managing your own health care and how you can take the lead role, how best to take ownership of your health care experience. And our guest is Dr. Melissa Clark, MD. She's a Harvard-educated physician with over 20 years' experience, also a healthcare educator and a patient advocate. And Dr. Clark is passionate about helping patients become powered and informed, and particularly now in 2014 as the Affordable Care Act kicks in. And she's author of a new book with the intriguing title, Excuse Me, Doctor, I've Got What? And it's subtitled, Taking Ownership of Your Health and Making Healthcare Reform Work for You. And certainly that's a timely topic as we begin 2014. And hello, Dr. Clark, and welcome to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age.
Hi, Roy. Thanks for having me, and thanks for that great introduction.
Well, we'll leave politics on the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare to practically every other talk show on the planet. But briefly, from a practical standpoint, how is Obamacare likely to impact middle-aged Americans as they go about hopefully controlling their healthcare experiences?
Well, it's already impacted quite a few people. Number one, it's changed the insurance industry in terms of making sure that the minimum policies that insurance companies offer are ones that cover preventive care, as well as all the catastrophic things that can happen, hospitalizations, the need for rehab, mental health issues, substance abuse issues, et cetera.
Yeah.
So that's one way that it's already sort of impacted what's going on. And then as some middle-agers move into being seniors, it's already
an unfortunate movement for all of us.
Absolutely. but a beautiful one, because a lot of people don't make it there. So,
well, that's true.
You know, my motto is to give thanks for every day. But for those of us who are, you know, moving into being seniors, it closes the donut hole, which is that amount of what you pay out of pocket for prescription medicines under Medicare Part D. It helps to make sure that there are enough subsidies so that you're not paying that full amount out of pocket, which is how it is now. And then it also makes sure, too, that seniors and older middle-aged adults aren't paying more, significantly more than young people for the same kinds of health insurance.
Yes, that's right. And I think in your book you mentioned that it shifts maybe a portion of containing health care costs more. That's kind of shifted onto the shoulders of health care consumers, and that you will be more expected to know about your own health and take preventative measures and that kind of thing and go regularly to the doctor for checkups. How does that work exactly?
Well, you know, the whole reason for the Affordable Care Act and for the debate in Washington all these years about what to do about health care is because costs are going through the roof.
Yeah.
And so one solution that's already underway is to, again, shift some of that cost onto the backs of consumers, so to speak.
Yeah.
So healthcare consumers are going, again, expected to be up on their health, to go for regular preventive checkups. And one of the main barriers to being able to do that, your insurance premiums or having insurance, is taken care of by the Affordable Care Act, so that when you go for preventive care, you have insurance, and there are no copays and no deductibles.
Yeah, that's a wonderful aspect.
But it's more than that. It's also being able to successfully navigate the healthcare system and get out of each interaction what you specifically need, which is one of the main reasons I wrote, "Excuse me, doctor, I've got what?"
Well, early in your book, you urge any reader that's confronted with a major illness not to become a passive patient, but rather to be an empowered healthcare consumer. What's the difference between being a patient and an empowered consumer? I love that distinction that you've made there in your book.
Excellent question, Roy. So the word patient, I'm really big into where words come from.
Yeah.
It comes from the root word in Latin, which is to suffer.
Oh, great.
And I know. Can you believe that?
Yeah.
And sure, being sick feels like suffering, but unfortunately the experience of being a patient is very much like suffering. It puts us in the mindset of being passive, of just waiting for whatever to happen to us, you know, to take place. It makes us feel powerless.
Yeah.
So the main difference between being a patient and being an empowered healthcare consumer is one of perspective, of understanding that we really are the ones who have the main control over our own health, and that there are specific things that we can do when we interact with our doctor, go to the hospital, deal with our insurance company, to make sure that the interaction is a positive one and benefits us at all times.
Yeah, I like that, where you said that also patient is talking about being patient, waiting for the doctor, waiting for x-rays, waiting for the healthcare provider to do all the work. That really doesn't make a lot of sense, because who has more at stake in assuring the proper treatment and getting going on recovery than you, the patient? I almost said patient myself, you, the consumer.
Right. And, you know, I always say that healthcare is the last frontier. Every other major purchase that we do in our lives, we do our research. If we're going to buy a washing machine or a refrigerator or a car or a house, you know, we research the neighborhood and the warranties and all this. But when it comes to our health, we just kind of roll over and, you know, kind of take what we get.
Yeah, that's right.
But the truth of the matter is that, again, we are the ones who have the most control over our own bodies. And I always give this analogy. We have, you know, 60 billion cells in our heart.
Oh,
and as we get older, our heart cells actually turn over faster and create a whole new heart in about 3 to 4 years. So the fact that our body is constantly recreating itself means that we actually have a lot of input, what we eat, how we treat our body, how we deal with stress in our lives. And we talk about all that in Excuse Me, Doctor, as to how we can kind of take control over those things that impact how well our bodies create and repair itself every day.
Yeah, you mentioned that, you know, whatever the initial diagnosis, you still, you as a person have control over several aspects of your lifestyle. They remain firmly within your control. And you mentioned diet and also getting sunlight, which is kind of tough to do around here right now.
Sure.
I think you said 15 minutes a day. We don't have any sun right now, and it's about 7 degrees. But and then you mentioned sleep, 7 or 8 hours a night, which is we had a program previously on sleep. I know how important that is. And also you mentioned water, drinking a glass of water before each meal and between meals. And and of course, then there's that healthy way to cope with stress, which is not always easy.
That's a biggie. It's a biggie.
Yeah.
But one way to get around the whole no sunlight in the wintertime is just to make sure that you have a diet that's rich in foods that have vitamin D, and get your vitamin D level checked. And if it's really low, below 30, then talk with your doctor, or your doctor will prescribe vitamin D supplements for you and how much you should take. So that's a way to get around the sunlight issue.
Well, let's assume that you've just been diagnosed with a serious life-threatening disease like cancer, for instance, or something like that. To avoid becoming paralyzed in fear, what are some initial steps that you can take to get over that initial? I know when you hear that word cancer, you just, you know, life seems to end right there for some people. And it,
sure. Well, one thing is realizing that life doesn't end all the time with cancer. There are many cancers that are treatable, and many people go on to live productive lives with that diagnosis.
Yeah, I've been alive for 25 years now since I was diagnosed with cancer. I don't know how productive my life has been. That would be up to someone else, but, you know, it certainly is treatable. My wife also is a recovered cancer patient. So.
Absolutely. I think it said that, like, maybe one in four people may have some sort of diagnosis of cancer in their lifetime, and that's because about 100,000 cancer cells pop up in our bodies every single day. And our body actually takes care of that problem. Our immune system polices itself. And it's only when, for some reason, our immune system is off because of one of those five things that you can take control of, does a cancer cell kind of take root and grow. So number one is, you know, taking control of your lifestyle. Number two, overcoming that passive patient mindset that we talked about, and specifically depression, because a lot of people, when they have a diagnosis at first, they become depressed, and they might not even realize it. So there are two kind of screening questions that I say, if you're a loved one of someone who has cancer, or you have cancer yourself, to ask yourself. One is, have I felt, or have you felt sad for most of the time over the past 2 weeks? Or have you lost interest or pleasure in most of all your usual activities? And if that's the case, getting help for your mental health and for your depression, because depression makes any disease worse.
I like the portion, the point in your book where you say to ask for loving support, and you know, don't try to hide the fact that you're fighting against cancer or whatever. Tell people about it and ask for their help, and that's
absolutely
a huge benefit. I also like the, you know, there's so many organizations out there on the internet that we didn't have before, where you can look for, like, organizations of fellow patients or people that have recovered from the disease you have, or who are going through it, and that must be comforting to have that kind of support.
Right. I mean, you can find that through the American Cancer Society, how to find those groups. But you can also find a counselor, a minister, or talk with your doctor about a referral to a psychologist or a psychiatrist, you know, to help manage those symptoms. They don't always have to be managed with medication, but they have to be addressed. It's crucial.
Well, you recommend as a third step to put together a healthcare team. But as a layperson with little intimate knowledge of healthcare practitioners and their specific skills and areas of expertise, how can you do this? And how do you avoid conflict with your primary care physician or the specialist who diagnosed the disease, who probably has their own referrals that they want to make? I just don't know how you go about it. How can I tell my oncologist about who should treat my cancer, for instance?
Right. And you shouldn't. But one thing, again, in Excuse Me, Doctor, Chapter 5, it's all about what healthcare providers do you need on your team.
Yeah.
And one of the things we go through in that chapter are all the various conventional doctors there are, and what they do and what they're good for.
Yeah, I love that.
And then all the various non-conventional or complementary doctors and practices that they use.
Yeah.
And in there I highlight things like acupuncture, which is great for helping to control the nausea and vomiting associated with chemotherapy, and a lot of the pain that's a side effect of chemotherapy and cancer. We also talk about hypnosis. Again, hypnosis, the same thing, great for controlling those symptoms that are hard to control when you have cancer, various kinds of cancers. And so, you know, you can talk with your healthcare provider about that, with your oncologist or your primary care doctor, about getting referrals or just making sure that you tell them that you're exploring these other options.
Yeah, that's for sure. Just to have the knowledge and be an informed customer, know what an ND, the difference is an MD and an ND.
And an ND, exactly. There's also an integrative physician.
Yeah.
Integrative physicians are ones who are conventional MDs or DOs, the regular doctors that you are familiar with, but who have studied other healing modalities and incorporate them into their practice. And they're great to find if you're somebody who's interested in looking at other ways of approaching health and wellness and treatment.
Yeah, we had a guest last fall who, Master Chan, who's actually, or Master Shaw, I guess it was, he's actually trained in Western medicine, but also in ancient Chinese medicine and techniques. That was quite a combination. He was a very interesting guest. Well, your recommended fourth step is to screen healthcare professionals carefully. And once again, as a layperson, how can I do this? And under most of today's insurance plans, do I have much choice in terms of selecting them?
Sure. So, it does depend on your insurance as to what doctors are in the network of that insurance company.
Yeah.
Sometimes people have plans where they can pay a little extra and go to a doctor out of network, and if you have a doctor that you really like, it's worth doing that.
Yeah,
or you can call your insurance company and say, hey, can you please cover this person? But first of all, it's important to make sure that any doctor that you're with is board certified, because that's a recognition of competency in their field. And you can check that on the Federation of State Medical Boards website. And it also will let you know if there are any strikes against that doctor, if they've had any disciplinary problems in the past. And on a positive side, you can go to the NCQA.org website. That stands for National Committee on Quality Assurance, NCQA. And what they've done is they have recognized doctors who practice with a patient-centered philosophy and approach to care, which means that they put the patient, obviously, at the center of care. They inform you, keep you informed. They work with you as a partner. They're collaborative in their decision-making. And these doctors have been recognized by NCQA as doing this. And you could just enter your zip code and find the doctors in your area.
Well, that's wonderful. I never didn't know about that. It's NQCA.com.
NCQA.org.
.org.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that .org is important. Absolutely.
Well, another one of your recommendations is to break through to have a good functional rapport with your doctor or practitioner. But what if that person, the doctor, lacks good listening skills? And, you know, all the doctors I've dealt with recently have just been wonderful. They've been open to discussion and tell me what's going on, and just wonderfully warm and receptive. But what if the doctor is not a very good bedside manner? He has, is very skilled, and you know he's an excellent doctor, but he doesn't really want to listen to you. How do you establish that rapport? Any suggestions on how you might be able to do that?
Well, one of the things that I'm really a huge advocate of is taking your own inventory and deciding what's important to you. For some people, bedside manner isn't as important as knowing that that person is technically excellent.
Yeah.
So if that's on the top of your priority list and you're willing to deal with somebody who doesn't have great bedside manner, you know, that's fine too. But I really think that there are many doctors out there who are technically proficient and knowledgeable, but have the skill set to relate to you. And I think what we've done in Chapter 7 of Proactively Choose the Right Provider for You is go through those seven set of questions that you can use to interview your doctor to determine if this is somebody you really want to work with in the long term.
Yeah, we always talk about the doctor interviewing you with your symptoms, but you should be interviewing the doctor as well.
Exactly. You're an empowered healthcare consumer. It's what you would do with any other service you were looking for, right?
Yeah.
So evaluate their listening skills, and we talk about ways to do that, their attention span, their capacity for compassion, their openness to other healing traditions. And again, some of these might not be important to you, but I'm including them in case they are.
Yeah.
And then clarity in explanations. Do they use simple language?
Yeah.
Do they include you in decision-making, and do they explain all your options to you?
Yeah.
And then finally, do they appear to know their limitations? If you ask them a question that they don't know the answer to, do they seem defensive or evasive, or do they say, I don't know, let me get you the answer, or let me point you
great.
In the direction?
That's the kind of doctor I would want, is one that would readily admit that that wasn't their area of expertise and offer to refer you to somebody that, or to themselves get the answer to that. But
exactly.
Well, what can you do prior to each doctor visit or interaction with a healthcare professional that will help ensure a productive appointment as you go through the various treatment phases or the diagnosis phases? What should you do to prepare for the appointments you have? I know that was another step in your
absolutely. Book. So this is actually in Chapter 7, relating to your doctor, how to be your best advocate.
Oh, right.
So it's talking really about being a prepared healthcare consumer. So when you go for your visits, a lot of people already know, you're supposed to take a list of your medicines or at least take the medicines with you.
My wife
and
always
be prepared
reminds
to,
me of that.
What's that?
I said my wife always reminds me of that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then be prepared to answer questions about your health history, especially if this is the first time seeing the doctor.
Yeah.
But one of the things we go over in that chapter is, what are the 5 questions that you should never leave the doctor's office without having answered? So the first is, what's wrong with me? And the explanation needs to be in simple language. And it shouldn't be a reiteration of, you know, your symptoms. You came in with knee pain. The diagnosis shouldn't be knee pain.
No.
It should be the top 3 things the doctor thinks is wrong, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Then the next one is, what do I need to know about the treatment, its effects, so how long is it going to take to kick in, side effects, and how much it costs? Because if it's too costly or it's not covered by your insurance, you're not going to take it.
That's for sure.
The third is, what are the alternatives to taking the prescribed treatment? Always remember, you have a choice. You have an option.
Yeah.
You might choose to take, not to take it, which might not be the best choice, but it's your choice, and you need to know what the consequences are.
That's true.
What are the next steps?
What
do you want me to do when I leave here? Do you want me to make an appointment with a oncologist or with an orthopedist? Or do you want me to see a psychologist? And will you make those appointments, or do you have referrals, or do you want me to make those appointments?
Yeah.
And then finally, what are the self-care actions I need to do at home? How often do you want me to take my medicine? Do you want me to lose 10 pounds? Over what period of time? Do you want me to check my blood sugars? How often? How do I do that? So be really clear about what is the doctor's expectation of you in terms of what behaviors you need to be doing when you go home.
Yeah, I like also your point about always bringing a health buddy along, because I know if you're from my own personal experience, if I'm diagnosed with cancer or something like that, I probably don't hear much. I'm so upset and nervous, I don't really take good notes
or
I'm not very objective the rest of the visit.
Yeah, you're hitting the nail on the head. We talk about that extensively throughout the book, about the importance of having a health buddy with you, because when you're at the doctor's office, frankly, they've done studies. You know, people retain less than 50% of what the doctor tells them.
Yeah.
And it could be because, again, you've gotten shocking news, or you're just not feeling well, or you're on some kind of medicine that's altering your ability to focus and concentrate.
That's true. Yeah.
So it's really crucial to take somebody you trust and somebody who's has kind of that advocate personality, who's not afraid to ask questions and represent your interest and is detail-oriented. So, that's crucial.
Well, here's another interesting point you make in your book. During hospitalization, you say that you should create a positive hospital experience, but if I'm flat on my back in bed, not feeling very well, how do I make certain that my caregivers are communicating and pulling together and that I'm getting the kind of, you know, actively seeking to get the kind of treatment that I should be getting? I mean, it's kind of tough to do when you're lying in bed.
It is. And again, that's one of the reasons that the emphasis so much is on having a health buddy. Some hospitals actually also have patient navigators who can also, and patient representatives who can also help you. But there's nothing like having, you know, a loved one or a family member who can be there with you as much of the time as possible, and alert your nurse if something seems wrong, or alert your doctor.
I like that point where you said be a squeaky wheel.
Be a squeaky wheel, absolutely. And, you know, because squeaky wheels get the most oil. And, you know, I can even say from my years of practicing in the emergency department, you know, we're always taking care of the most of the sickest person that comes through the door.
Yeah.
And so the people who, you know, may not be advocating for themselves, or a family member's not coming up and saying, hey, you know, we've been waiting an hour, the lab test back, you know, those are the ones that get the attention.
Yeah.
And the ones who aren't as vocal aren't getting as the attention as fast possibly as they could. So it's really important to make sure that, again, you have an advocate, or you're not afraid to speak up for yourself.
No. Well, this is a crucial question for a lot of us. Can you obtain generally a reliable estimate in advance from hospitals, physicians, whoever, of what, and your insurance carrier, obviously, of what the likely ultimate out-of-pocket cost for your treatment is going to be? Like, what will it cost? What will your insurance cover? What portion are you going to be responsible for? And maybe the estimated time away from work if you're employed and you're off without pay. And the is it easy to get a pretty good feel for that in advance, or how do you go about doing that so that you're not shocked with the? I know you have a reference in your book of a fellow that got treated and then had a huge financial burden after the treatment was over.
Sure. Yeah. Unfortunately, there isn't a good way yet, a reliable way yet.
Hmm.
There are some websites out there that can kind of give you an idea of what you might pay for certain procedures, but they have not yet gotten it down to the science of saying, okay, at hospital A and with Dr. A, you're going to pay XYZ for a shoulder replacement, for example. But that's coming. I mean, they're working on that to make sure that that data will be available for the public so that, again, you can make informed decisions based on cost.
Yeah.
Right now, there's some websites like healthcarebluebook.com that, just like the car blue book, will give you an idea of what certain procedures should cost.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
As far as being out of work, that's something that you can, information you should just ask your doctor up front, and they should be able to give you a reasonable estimate, number one, of how long your hospitalization will be and how long your recovery time will be and what activities you should be able to do when in your recovery, including go back to work.
Yeah, well, if there's a sad reality that you don't think you can afford the estimated out-of-pocket cost for your preferred treatment at the preferred hospital, is it possible sometimes to get a hardship break from that preferred hospital or the physician? Is there
most
like charity
definitely. Most definitely. So one of the things we cover in Chapter 10 of Excuse Me, Doctor, in it's called Financing Your Care, that chapter, talks about what to do in terms of negotiating. That's huge. Being able to negotiate both doctor bills and hospital bills after they're incurred.
Yeah.
Go through the hospital bill, see things that you don't understand and ask what they are, and sometimes they're things that you didn't actually receive.
Yeah.
So those can come off the top right away.
Yeah.
And then sit down with the hospital billing agent and go through, you know, what you're able to pay or what you're not able to pay, and negotiate that bill down. You should at least ask for at least 20% off, because if it goes to collections, that's what the hospital is going to pay the collections agency.
Oh, I see.
So, you know, immediately see about taking those things off.
Yeah.
And then in terms of copays and deductibles, there are actually organizations out there, foundations, that can help you manage things like copays. So there's the Copay Relief Fund, associated with the Patient Advocate Foundation. There's the Chronic Disease Fund for medications. There's the Partnership for Prescription Assistance. So in that last chapter, we go through a lot of what those resources are that an individual can use if they get all of a sudden this huge hospital bill or huge deductible, huge copay that they would have to struggle or just frankly can't pay.
Yeah. No, that's great to know. And again, your book is a great reference for that in that chapter 10, like you said. And the one final question, if you're not satisfied with the conventional treatment or if it just isn't working, when and how should you consider a clinical trial? And is it a good chance you could get selected for one of those? Or how can you help your chances to be included in a clinical trial? And will insurance generally pay for that? Or
great question. So the first thing is, how do you find out about them? You can go to clinicaltrials.gov.
Oh.
It's a government website that lists all the clinical trials there are out there. You can ask your doctor, or you can go through specialty societies, associations, like, for example, if the American Cancer Society, if you have cancer, or the Alzheimer's Association, if you have Alzheimer's, and find out what clinical trials you can be matched to.
Oh, I see.
So that's the first step.
Yeah.
And then the folks who are doing the trial sit down with you and determine whether you meet the criteria, the eligibility, and what will be required of you. And then you have to make the decision, is this something that I want to do?
Yeah.
Knowing that it's not always going to be guaranteed that you get into the section of the study or the arm of the study where the treatment is being given.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times they give a group what's called a placebo, something that's not active.
You don't
want to
be
see
in
the
placebo
difference.
Group.
Right, but you don't. Most times you don't have any control over that.
No.
So it's a risk, but sometimes, you know, if you feel that conventional treatment is not working, you really don't have any other alternatives, it's a risk that many people will take.
Yeah, my wife's sister was diagnosed with lung cancer over a year ago, and she got into this experimental treatment on a new form of chemo for lung cancer that she obtained through the University of Michigan, and she's better now than she was at the beginning of the trial.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. And then you also asked if insurance will cover it. I'm not sure if your sister-in-law's insurance covered it.
Well,
but
she's elderly, so she's under Medicare. I'm sure it is. I don't think she's getting any. Well, I think the university is financing it, basically, in their experiment. But
well, what insurance companies do is they will pay for everything that is in the usual conventional care for that condition.
Oh, yeah.
But whatever the intervention is, you know, the drug or the procedure that's being tested, they won't pay for.
And
a lot of times the trial will, the investigators will pick up that cost.
Yeah, that apparently is what's happening, because I know she's not out of a bunch of money on this at all. But
is actually one benefit of a clinical trial, is a lot of times you don't have to pay anything out of pocket for whatever intervention you get.
Well, tell us about your book, Excuse Me, Doctor, I've Got What. It's really like a manual, isn't it? It's something you don't just read through once, but you probably read through once, and then you can go back and refer to specific sections as treatment questions come up. It seemed very valuable in that manner.
I specifically wrote it to be a manual. Again, something you can read through, but something that you can go back and reference, because the whole title, Excuse Me, Doctor, I've Got What, that's something that I heard said to me many times as a doctor, and I've said it myself.
Yeah.
And those people who say it are on a journey to reclaim their health.
Yeah.
But when you try to do that, it's like being dropped in the middle of a forest and being told, you know, find your way out with no compass, no guide, no GPS. And so Excuse Me, Doctor is really meant to serve that purpose, to be that guide. And I try to make it easy for people to reference by putting at the end of each chapter checklists
that
you can refer to.
Checklist always helps you refresh what you just read and pinpoints it so that it's in simple little bullet point like.
Right. So, for example, when you go to the doctor, those five things that we talked about, you shouldn't leave the doctor's office without asking, page 149, that checklist has those questions that you can take the book with you to the doctor and just read those questions off and make sure that you know you've had it. I've had several people tell me that that they do that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's an easy read. At the beginning of each chapter, there are anecdotes from my experience, from patients' experience I've encountered over the years to kind of make that chapter come alive. Again, it's meant to be a comprehensive reference.
Well, it definitely would be a book that I'd want to read if I or a loved one had recently been diagnosed with any kind of a life-threatening disease or a chronic condition, you know, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, cancer, whatever, anything that, you know, is scary and long-term. And where can a listener preview your book? What's the best place to go to obtain it and preview it? And
Sure. ExcuseMeDoctor.com. So doctor spelt out D-O-C-T-O-R, just like the title of the book, ExcuseMeDoctor.com. And you can, you know, see an excerpt from the book. There's a little trailer there. You can watch that if you're into that. And you can purchase the book from that site as well.
Yeah.
And then I love to hear from people. I love to get feedback. So my website, Dr. Melissa Clark, that's D-R this time, Dr. Melissa Clark has an E on the end, DrMelissaClark.com. And I'm also on Facebook at Dr. Melissa Clark and Twitter at Dr. Melissa Clark.
Yeah, I noticed you were on. And also you can get that book through Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com. And I noticed there were some very positive customer reviews on both those sites. So,
great. Okay.
There's plenty of places to go. And I certainly appreciate you for being with us today. And thank you so much. And the best of success in the sale of this most valuable book. And I think this is definitely a time of the year with this Affordable Care Act coming into play that anyone who expects to face or is facing now any kind of a serious illness, and most of us will at some point in our lives, that's definitely a book they'd want to get a hold of.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Roy. I really appreciate it.
And thanks for being here. Thanks so much, Dr. Clark. Well, in closing our program today, I'll go over what I like to call the Ten Commandments of Midlife Renewal. And although you may not be able to follow them all, abiding by as many as possible will help ensure a smooth transition to a joyful, productive second half of life on your own terms. Got a pencil, pen, or iPod ready? Here we go. Commandment number one, I will not renew alone. You know, teamwork is a major boost to accomplishing personal renewal goals. Players on successful teams challenge one another, and your team will need an outstanding coach or mentor, but it doesn't necessarily have to be a live in-person coach. Alternatives are an inspirational book, blogs, or a CD, or perhaps someone just to keep a tab and make sure that you're making progress, someone you're responsible to. Members of successful teams hone personal skills through exchange of information, repetitive practice drills, friendly internal competition, and inspiration for lagging mates. You become responsible for someone else's success, and teammates become responsible for you, and that's a win-win situation. So set out and find some like-minded individuals who also desire to wake up to a better life and join forces if you possibly can. Commandment number two, I will affirm faith in a supreme being and will ask for help. Now, this commandment is optional, and it's for anyone who believes in an active, loving God. And you are not likely to accomplish renewal if you're alienated from the greater power and from your fellow human beings. So if you're spiritually oriented, pray for divine guidance before each renewal session. You know, a combination of faith in the divine, along with positive expectations of success, is certainly a winning combination. Commandment number three, I will reaffirm belief in myself. You know, to effectively renew life midstream, you will need a positive vision of the inner you, of your potential for greatness. So right now, repeat after me. I am a cherished, totally unique member of the human race with potential far greater than I even imagine. Say that to yourself right now. You know, in return for giving of yourself in service to others, you will receive recognition and reward from others in service to you. Jesus said, love your neighbor as yourself, and it's very important that you learn to love yourself first, because you can't really love another unless you love and honor yourself. An affirmation of true self will drive thoughts of failure right out of your mind. Commandment number 4, I will renew as a two-step process. Step 1 is to seek inner peace and positive emotional balance, affirming your strengths today and the direction in which you're headed tomorrow. And step 2 is to establish and maintain favorable interpersonal relationships with loved ones, workmates, and others you meet along the way. In other words, you renew internally, and then you demonstrate to others that you are renewed. And you must always be willing, obviously, to respect differences and others' points of view along the way. Commandment number 5, I will expand my horizons and will think outside the lines. To move forward to a richer, fuller life, you may need to abandon your present comfort zone. And if you're unhappy with life today, it certainly doesn't make any sense to continue what you've been doing that isn't working, does it? Search for creative new outlets to apply your talents and desires. And if you're presently sitting on a tack, it makes absolutely no sense not to move to a different place on the deck, does it? Commandment number 6 is, I will disassociate myself from negative thoughts and from negative people. Now, I know it's not always easy to disassociate yourself from negative people if that negative person is your spouse, your boss, or one of your teenage sons or daughters. Hopefully, over time, you will bring them around to your positive point of view. Also, there are probably a lot of friendships and associations where you do have choices to avoid those people. You can certainly stay away from that gossip circle down the street. But if you you can refuse to join in negative commentary or to second negative remarks, and you don't let that dominate your thought process, because remember, no one else can make you feel sad or angry. And as you condition your mind to routinely envision a positive outcome and a brighter tomorrow, you will begin to spread goodwill and positive expectations to persons around you, and you will stop attracting the negative and will begin attracting the positive. Commandment number 7, I will treat midlife renewal as a major life project. When you think about it, what is more important than transforming your life? Changing one's outlook on life from negative to positive is certainly a life-altering project worthy of the highest priority. So I would treat the renewal process with the same intensity and the same commitment as you have other life-altering opportunities, like courting your spouse years ago, perhaps, or applying for a new job, or maybe seeking a promotion at your work, because bringing your life into a positive glow and outlook on the future is certainly worth all the effort. Commitment number 8, I will renew both my body and my mind. You know, it's extremely difficult, if not impossible, to have a consistently positive, energetic outlook when you're trapped in an out-of-shape, overweight, and undernourished body. So healthy diet and exercise help us to relax and sharpen our minds, and added energy makes us more enthusiastic about the hours and days ahead. So work on getting in shape along with honing your mind. Commandment number 9, I will begin to think and behave like a renewed person even before the results are all in. You know, you need not wait for a radical positive change in your career or a lifestyle advancement to begin thinking and behaving like a winner. You act like you're rehearsing continuously for a positive end result. That's the way to do it. As a small child, you knew that imagination worked, and it still can if you have the right attitude as an adult. Continually visualize a positive outcome on your own terms, and your dreams will begin to turn into reality, I promise. You can work out the precise methods that you will use later. They'll come to you along the way, believe me. Commandment number 10, I shall seek continuously to expand my circles of cooperation. You can advance your post-renewal life through a fluid network of transitory and permanent interaction with others to get things done. You follow positive or fellow positive like-minded individuals will gravitate to you, and you will gravitate to them. And without doubt, as a renewed person, you will recognize that cooperation requires give and take with winners all around, nobody stays positive for long or gets ahead by taking advantage of other people. We all know that. Circles of cooperation may be formal or informal, constant or fluid, but by nature you will find comfort from working with others. The bottom line, if you haven't already, launch your journey to midlife renewal this very day using these 10 commandments or whatever other commandments you can think of to get the job done. What's holding you back? The moment you become convinced deep inside of the inevitability of your ultimate success, nothing will hold you back. Your prize is lifelong joy and fulfillment in the new, wide-awake, positive version of you. And I describe the 10 Commandments of Renewal in much greater detail in Chapter 10 of my book, A Midlife Challenge Wake Up, by me, Roy C. Richards. And this is just one of 18 chapters in my comprehensive roadmap to renewal of body, mind, and spirit at middle age. And I include 21 self-help exercises to help ensure that you're not just reading, but you're testing out and applying renewal concepts to your own life. And you can preview and purchase my book at Amazon.com or BarnesandNobles.com. Better yet, you can come to our website, www.middleagerenewal.com. That's www.middleagerenewal.com. And by doing that, you can receive a free gift as well. So come to our website. That's middleagerenewal.com. And thanks for joining us. And tune in next week, when our guest will suggest how you can market yourself both in your career and in daily interactions where you seek to encourage cooperation from others. And as you venture out into the world today, remember, as always, our motto, middle age can be and is your best age. And thank you for joining us. Have a good day.
You've been listening to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age, hosted by Roy Richards, an expert on midlife renewal and author of both A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up, and Wake Up, Captain and Crew, Restart Your Engines. You can learn more about Roy and his Middle Age Renewal Training System by visiting his website, middleagerenewal.com.